But Paul does not come in tomorrow, nor does he appear the next day. The weekend goes by without word from him. Monday morning turns into Monday afternoon, and still there is no sign.
Maybe he has writer's block, Kevin says.
Maybe his muse has deserted him,
Jürgen says.
That is what happened to Gerhard, the leader of my reggae band, Gerhard and the Mergers. After his receptionist transferred to head office in Frankfurt, he did not write a single song?
I am his muse, I point out. I have not deserted him. I am waiting for him right here.
Yes, it is perhaps the less familiar situation of the artist deserting his muse,
Jürgen says, frowning.
I wouldn't worry about it, Claude, he says. Didn't you say he was doing plot changes?
He was trying to think up new directions for the book.
There you go, then, she says. These things take their own time. You can't push the river. That's what my Uncle Nick always tells the people in the Dole office. In fact, Ish is almost as eager to see Paul herself in order to share a discovery she has made about the island of Torabundo. Today it's basically the financial services center, only on a beach and with bigger spiders. But it used to be part of this really famous cooler ring. She looks at our blank faces.
The gift economy? Malinowski, Marcel Mauss, all that?
Are you having an acid flashback? Kevin says.
Gift economies are how everything worked before we had markets, she explains. Instead of buying things from each other, people would just give each other what they needed. You give me a calabash of milk, I give you a shell adze. You pass the adze on to my cousin, I share the milk with your grandmother, and so on and so on.
You are talking about barter, Jürgen says. The system that existed before money was invented and people no longer had to carry around adzes looking for someone to swap them with.
Not barter. They didn't exchange things. They gave things. Whenever anthropologists travel to places where people still lived like that, without markets, I mean, instead of barter, they found these gift circles. And one of the most famous examples was this island about 100 miles from Torabundo called Kokomoko. I actually went there with Tog a few years back after we studied it at uni. A French anthropologist wrote a book about it. What she found was that people on Kokomoko didn't hold on to anything. No one owned anything. Instead, everything just cycled around constantly. Small things like tools and food and clothes, but big things too. Kokomoko was famous for these beautiful necklaces, for instance. And they'd give them to the tribes on the neighbouring islands. Like they'd sail over to Torabundo and there'd be a gifting ceremony with a big feast. But the Torabundans wouldn't keep them. They'd sail onto the next island a few months later and pass the necklaces on to the tribe there. And the tribe would pass them on again to the next island. And meanwhile, there were other gifts from other tribes, cowries and arrowheads or whatever it might be, going from island to island in the opposite direction. That's the cooler ring. All of these islands, hundreds of miles apart, brought together by gifts.
What's the point of that? Kevin says.
What's the point of what?
Just randomly giving each other things for no reason.
Well, why do you buy rounds of drinks in the pub? Ish says. Why doesn't everyone go up and buy their own drink?
I have often wondered this very same thing,
Jürgen says.
Financially speaking, the Irish mania for rounds makes no sense, particularly if I am drinking a relatively inexpensive Pilsner lager and I might be forking out for someone else's costly whiskey and coke. Even if they then buy me a beer, I still incur a net loss.
Yeah, but that's the point, he says.
That I incur a net loss?
If I buy something from you, you hand it over and we both walk away and that's the end of our relationship. That's the market economy in a nutshell. But if I give you something, even if it's just a drink that I know you're going to get me back, then there's a bond created between us that carries on into the future. Like, a social bond. So on these islands, gifts were a way of tying everybody together, like the different families, the different tribes, and so on. Not just them either, but the dead and the living too, because they believed that when you give a gift, a part of your soul goes with it and joins with whoever else's soul that gave it before. And at these feasts, they'd recite the histories of the arm shells or the necklaces or the cowries or whatever it might be, and the stories of their ancestors who were still present in these magical objects. So instead of just walking out of a shop, they stay connected over generations.
What if you didn't want to stay connected? Kevin says.
Why wouldn't you want to be connected?
Because you don't feel like handing over all your stuff?
Look, say you're living on an island in the Pacific and your next-door neighbour needs an awl to tool some leather. And you've got an awl, you're not going to keep it from him, are you? Because you know sometime down the line you'll need something from him, like food or a knife or a pair of shoes. Or just a friendly word, someone to look in on you if you're sick. You know it's important to preserve that relationship, in short.
I just tell him to go down the awl shop and get his own, Kevin says.
Right, and for the rest of your life you wouldn't talk to anyone around you and you'd just curl up every night alone with your awl, would you?
I'd have a really good one, Kevin says.
I think what Kevin is saying, I interject, is that we can see what they are trying to do with these networks of exchange, but they do seem to introduce a lot of unnecessary complication.
Claude, we're working in like the epicenter of unnecessary complication. She waves a hand at the glass towers, their 30,000 inhabitants. And what's it all for?
It is precisely to ensure that moneyed individuals can continue to stockpile wealth in peace, Jürgen says, without constantly being interrupted by neighbours and similar nuisances looking for awls and other goods.
I wish you could see this place, Ish says wistfully. Then it'll all make sense to you. She looks out the window, and for a moment her face takes on a radiance quite different from the cold grey early morning light lifting in from the river. Anyway, the point is Torbendo dropped out of the Coolaring to be an offshore tax haven, so now you've got the gift economy and its absolute diametrical opposite side by side. That's bound to be something Paul can use, right? Like he could contrast the simple tribal island ways on Kokomoko with our miserable complex affluent ways, that sort of thing.
Is that the kind of spicing up he meant? I keep coming back to our conversation in the cafe.
At the time, it made me angry. He spends weeks poring over my life, then tells me there's nothing there. But I'm starting to see the problem from his point of view. He wants to give an honest account of life in the International Financial Services Center, but he also has a duty to frame some sort of narrative, to tell a story with a beginning, middle, and end. In a way, we face a similar dilemma with our clients. On the one hand, we commit to giving them an accurate account of what's happening in the market. On the other, we know that an accurate account is too complicated to be of any use to them. And so instead, we tell stories, turn companies into characters, quarterly reports into events, a chaos of global business into a few simple fables, ending with a buy or sell recommendation, which, if followed, will hopefully result in a profit. The truth is fine in principle, but stories are what sell. The robbery is unfeasible on a number of levels, although he is not the first to suggest it. My father had often proposed a bank heist, though he also suggested I go in with a machine gun and just shoot everyone. But the love story? On its own, that would show the banker's rich inner life without requiring any major changes to the rest of the plot. Waiting for a client one morning, I watch Ariadne from behind a menu and weigh her up. Her limbs are long, her movements as she glides down the narrow aisles of the restaurant fluid and graceful. She carries herself with a sort of gladiatorial kindness, smiling implacably at all comers. And her eyes, from her complexion I expect them to be brown, but instead they are startlingly vivid green, like a storm-lit sea, restive and electric. They continue to wrong-foot me every time I catch a glimpse of them, until she notices me staring and smiles, and I blush and pretend I wanted to order another coffee. Then something happens that puts the book out of everyone's mind. A little after midday, 7:05 a.m., New York time, Ish jumps out of her seat.
I just got an email from Porter Blankley!
A moment later, similar exclamations can be heard about the room. I look at my inbox.
I've got one too.
Kevin comes rushing up.
Porter Blankley sent us all emails, he says. It must be one of his inspirational memos,
Gary McCrum says.
Fuck,
Ish says.
Have you read it yet?
Kevin asks.
I'm too excited,
Ish says.
Claude, you open it.
Tentatively, as if handing a live wire,
I move the cursor over the envelope icon and click on it. The email consists of two words. Think counterintuitive, I read aloud.
Think counterintuitive?
Ish says.
Think counterintuitive,
Kevin mutters to himself. Around the office, the phrase can be heard repeated over and over, like a murmurous breeze circulating between the cubicles.
Is that inspirational?
Ish asks.
Do you feel inspired?
I definitely feel something,
Kevin says, frowning and assuming an odd posture, as though searching for his keys. Before there can be any further discussion, however, Jorgen appears to tell us that a very important email has just come in from Porter Blankley.
We know, Ish says.
Good,
Jorgen says.
Rachel has been in touch to say that each department must submit one major counterintuitive strategy by the end of the week. Until further notice, counterintuitiveness should be considered your top priority.
He is on the point of bustling off again, but Ish calls him back.
What does it mean?
She says. Jorgen pushes his glasses up his nose, surprised.
I have received only the same memo as you, but I'm guessing it means that instead of bowing to the prevailing wisdom and following the herd, we must now be innovating exciting new outside-the-box type alternatives.
Aye, says Ish.
How counterintuitive does he want us to be exactly?
Jocelyn Lockhart asks.
How counterintuitive?
Jorgen says.
Well, say if my intuition is telling me that it would be a bad idea to punch you in the face. Does that mean I should punch you in the face?
Or set fire to the computers?
Gary McCrum chips in.
Or stop working now and go to the pub, you know?
Jorgen strokes his chin thoughtfully.
These are good questions. Porter has not specified his parameters. Perhaps we should limit the counterintuitiveness to our respective fields for now, and later, if we find we're still bogged down in conventional mainstream thinking, we can experiment with more radical options such as face-punching.
Initially, the response to the new imperative is not entirely serious. Free pizza is mooted, paid nap time, daily meetings before the markets open in order to study staff dreams for potentially important data. A couple of days later, however, the strategy becomes less abstract. That morning, Kimberly the receptionist comes hurtling into the research department to tell us that a tramp is asleep in the supply cupboard. She wants to call security. The analysts, however, see an opportunity to demonstrate their machismo, and an armed response unit is quickly put together in the shape of the oil team leader, Brent Crude Kelleher, and his mountain biking cronies, Andrew O'Connor and Dwayne McGuckin.
How are you armed?
Ish asks. In unison, the armed response unit rolls up their sleeves and begins copious flexing of biceps. Not long after, though, they hurry back in, looking decidedly less intrepid. There is a tramp on the premises, they confirm. However, he is no longer asleep, or for that matter, in the supply cupboard. A moment later, with a guttural roar, a ragged figure lurches in. He is tall and spindly, with blazing eyes and a voluminous thicket of black beard that gives him the look of a medieval mendicant flagellating himself around Europe. Long streamers of duct tape hang from his shoulders. I can't understand what he's saying, but it is clear that he is very, very angry. He charges down the aisle between the cubicles in pursuit of the armed response unit, who career out of research into sales. A moment later, they reappear in the lobby, frantically jabbing the button for the lift. When its doors open and two enormous security guards jump out and dash after the tramp, who turns and speeds back towards his supply cupboard. Too late. We watch from our cubicles as the guards rugby tackle him, bring him crashing to the ground. Then one of them springs up to kneel on his back, while the other one prepares to hit him with his baton. The tramp howls out some kind of unintelligible imprecation, and the guard stops, baton frozen in the air.
Deist Vitalno, he says.
The tramp issues another screed. The security guard climbs off his back and says something apologetic. Now the tramp rises to his feet and straightens himself. The first security guard says something to the second security guard. Then both the security guards start obsequiously dusting down the tramp, who stares away into the middle distance with an imperial hauteur. Through the glass of the lobby, we see Liam English coming in our direction, fists clenched by his side. The armed response unit follow after him, looking chastened. Liam English dispatches the security guards with a single jab of his thumb. Then he embraces the tramp. BOT has a new employee. Grigory Erofiev, or Grisha, as he prefers to be called, although he makes it clear that ideally no one would speak to him at all, has been flown in directly from Moscow's Institute of Advanced Mathematics to head our new Structured Products Department, where he will come up with mind-bending combinations of currencies, futures, swaptions, and other entities, which the bank can sell on to clients and use on its own account. This constitutes a major change in BOT's direction.
Before the crash, every bank had to have at least one Russian physicist on its payroll. The bulge brackets would go on safari to St. Petersburg and return with whole university departments, setting them up in grim dorms to remind them of home, where they would sit gloomily eating pierogi and scrawling in refill pads. Sir Colin, our former CEO, saw this, and he saw so much of the 21st, 20th, and indeed 19th century as so much modern flimflam. He didn't believe investment banks ought to be trading for themselves at all. How could that not lead to a conflict of interest? And the idea of betting the house on equations, which nobody in the entire operation understood except for some depressed-looking Vlad in a pierogi-stained vest, he thought simply unhinged. But that's what makes it counterintuitive, see?
Howie is particularly excited by the new arrival.
Nobody's doing this stuff right now.
They're not doing it because it didn't work, I point out.
Crazy frog, you think the first airplane worked? You think the first telephone worked? The first shot of penicillin? I get the point. This guy is a visionary, Claude. He's out there, out in the fucking Siberian tundra, staring at the fucking sun and
Seeing what?
Seeing the shit that's going to take us to the next level!
Howie leans closer, lowers his voice. He's been telling me about his PhD. Providential antinomies. Ever heard of them? Of course you haven't. They haven't been used for 300 years. But guess what? Grisha has discovered some way of applying them to bond yields. To do what?
Howie flaps his hand in irritation.
I don't know. What they do isn't the point. The point is that this time we're the ones doing the crazy paradoxical rocket science shit. This tiny, insignificant little bank has, through the fluke of history, got a split-second start on the big boys. That's what Porter's counterintuitive strategy's about, see? If we wait for them to grow their balls back, they'll wipe us out. But if we take advantage of that head start and do all of the things that right now they're afraid to do, who knows how far we can go?
Grisha has been given his own office, a small, cramped box room behind the sales department with just a desk and a whiteboard. No TV, no Bloomberg, not even a phone. He doesn't seem to mind. He spends most of his time out on the plaza, apparently talking to the pigeons.
Look at that, Howie says approvingly, gazing down from the window. Mad as a nail. How can he not make us a fortune?
Porter's memo coincides with a golden streak for the bank such as I have never experienced before. Every call we make, every pitch, every trade, every merger, buyout, bond issue comes off as smoothly as a case study in an economics textbook. Europe teeters ever closer to the brink of some unimaginable financial apocalypse. Whole streets in Greece burn, and here the zombies by the riverside grow in number as the Royal Irish recapitalization, as predicted, fails completely. The fresh infusion stripped away by international speculators. But our share price leaps up. And up again, the whole world is long BOT. Yet to me, these successes seem somehow insubstantial. Without Paul there, everything has begun to slide out of focus, and the longer he is gone, the worse it gets. Figures blur on the screen, clients' voices merge into one another. I'm waylaid by memories. Things I haven't thought about in years, a game of tarot in my aunt's kitchen, my mother taking my hand as we cross the Pont des Arts. Perhaps it's to combat this that I find myself returning again and again to the Ark to watch Ariadne dance her pas de seul between the tables. How alive she is.
how embedded in her day. Even when she's daydreaming, standing still, she seems to throw off energy, invisible waves that ripple outward to catch up the people around her. Will she catch me up too? If the two strands of our story come together, might the writer come back in order to tie the knot?
Doing some reading?
What? Oh, yes. Beginning the Royal Irish Accounts.
But this is not accounts.
Jürgen fishes out the book stuffed under the stack of ledgers.
The Part et d'autre François Texier. Another novel?
Philosophy, I say gruffly, cheeks crimsoning. I thought it would be useful for something I'm planning to do.
Very good,
Jürgen says, but he does not leave. Instead, he parks himself upon the adjoining desk, gazes out for a moment at the rain, and then says,
"Do you know, Claude, an artist is not like a banker."
I open a folder, highlight a raft of redundant files.
"It is in an artist's nature to be mercurial," Jürgen continues. "Do you know this word, mercurial? It means prone to rapid and unexpected change, as liquid mercury is in the barometer."
"I am familiar with it," I say. The files yield up pale blue, translucent images of themselves, as if I am extracting their ghosts and transporting them to some electronic afterlife.
"It is a good word,"
Jürgen says.
"Mercurial. It is what Stacy calls Bobo, the clown, in Paul's book. You have reached that part where Stacy breaks up with Bobo."
"Of course," I mutter.
"Bobo, as a clown, is constantly searching for new jokes and new sensations. Stacy, as a health and safety officer, wants order and regularity. The two lifestyles are completely different. This is why she terminates the relationship."
"She does that in chapter 5, I object. "But then at the end she realizes she's still in love with him."
"I stopped reading after chapter 5,
Jürgen says. He broods over his folded arms for a moment. The recycling bin flashes indigo as the files are subsumed and resurrected as empty space.
"I suppose the thing to remember is that it is only a book,"
he says, getting up.
"Not real life."
On Tuesday morning, my team has a meeting with Cornerstone, one of several American private equity firms currently occupying the city's 5-star hotels. The market believes Ireland will soon go the same way as Greece: bankruptcy, riots, decades of national bondage. Value investors like Cornerstone are gambling the opposite. Operating on the principle that the moment of maximum pessimism is the best time to buy, they sift through the wreckage of Irish society, checking out shopping malls, stud farms, golf courses, whole estates of houses, businesses that can't stay afloat, and of course, the loan books of faltering Irish banks. We meet them at the hotel. There are three of them, tanned, sockless, in open-necked shirts and Patek Philippe watches, exuding an air of amused, joshing serenity. I do a surreptitious check for any giveaway tattoos. Many American bankers are ex-military, bland-faced, blue-eyed, faultlessly courteous men who went directly from their tour of Iraq or Afghanistan to MBAs in Wharton and Harvard. Indeed, the head of Cornerstone, General John Perseus, was one of the top commanders of the original invasion of Iraq. I suppose when you have seen an entire country being shelled to oblivion, holding your nerve during a bear run on the stock market does not present a major challenge. Cornerstone are interested in Royal Irish. That they have chosen to consult us about them is quite a feather in our cap. This morning, though, I cannot get the pitch straight in my head.
"Excuse me, let me just...
I awaken my laptop screen, squint at the spreadsheet. Numbers swim between the columns, decimal points dancing about like fleas. The three private equity bros gaze at me amusedly, serenely, hands draped loosely between their legs in the enormous leather armchairs.
"Of course, the patent data has already been set out for you in the accompanying file,"
Jürgen says, stepping in.
"If you will turn to page 4.
"File to prepare, prepare to file," Kevin says philosophically as we are leaving.
"What are you on about, Pipsqueak? Claude had the meeting out of his hand," Ish says.
Jürgen does not say anything, But when our car pulls up at the IFSC, he waits for the others to climb out and then turns to me. "You know, as a managerial policy, I do not believe in issuing threats or warnings," he says. "Yes," I say guiltily. But there is no more. With that, he gets out of the car, closing the door in my face.
"Maybe you need someone observing you," Ish hypothesizes. "You know, like electrons."
"Electrons?
What's that thing about electrons? You know that unless someone's there looking at them, they don't stay in the one spot. Instead, they're just sort of spread out all over the place."
"I have been working as an analyst for years without anyone observing me," I say.
"Maybe you didn't know you were an electron."
"I'm not an electron," I say.
"It is late. We are among the last ones left in the office. Outside, arrayed in the darkness, the buildings with their sparse panes of light look like monolithic dominoes waiting to fall."
"You've tried calling him?"
"Hundreds of times."
Ish tucks a pencil against her teeth.
"I wonder what happened," she says.
"It is obvious what happened," I snap. "He realized the novel wasn't going to work."
"Why wouldn't it work?"
"Why?"
I can't contain my anger any longer.
"Because what we do is empty, meaningless. No one in the world could find it interesting unless they were being paid."
"You don't know that's what happened. Wouldn't he have said something if he was just going to drop the whole thing? Like, why would he just disappear?"
I limit myself to another glower, push my brain to engage with the wall of numbers on the screen.
"Those new directions you said he was talking about," Ish says. "What were they, exactly?"
"What were they?" I repeat.
"Like, maybe there's a clue to what might have happened to him."
She gazes at me ingenuously. I have a momentary vision of Ariadne stepping towards me, cupping my face in her hands, bringing her lips to mine and experience a brief stab of pain.
"He didn't have anything concrete," I say.
She falls silent again. On her desk sits an ever-growing mountain of papers she's waiting to show to the writer. Articles about her gift island, photocopies from textbooks, Polaroids of her younger self, skinny, smudged, beaming with her arm around various stocky, topless tribespeople, like ingredients for a spell, as if she believes he might be able to summon her up out of her own past.
"Could it be," she says at last, "he wants you to find him?" "I told you he does not answer his phone." "No, I mean track him down. You said he was thinking up new directions for the book. Maybe this is it. This is what happens."
"The writer is in the book."
"Yeah, the banker has to help him. Like in that film, you know, with that guy."
"Find him." For some reason, the idea has never occurred to me before, as if the traffic between his life and mine could only ever be one way. It has, I must admit, a certain resonance. But how would we find him? He projected himself into our world without betraying any hint of his own, in spite of our best efforts.
"Maybe there's a clue in here."
Diving into her bag, she pulls out For Love of a Clown and starts flicking through it.
"Does he mention any neighborhoods? Can you remember?"
I frown. Mostly the clown is traveling around in a caravan or pitched up in a field with the rest of the circus, though there is a memorable scene near the end when the clown comes to Stacy's house and honks his nose outside her window.
"Wait a minute,"
Ish says, opening the book up again to the very first pages.
"Of course there's a clue in it. Look, the publisher's address is right here. Asterisk Press, Cromwell Road, London. They'll know where he is."
Genius. I seize the phone right there and then, but Ish reminds me that it's the middle of the night. "Right, right," I agree, setting it down again, but remaining on my feet full of nervous energy. I look at Ish, swiveling gently in her chair.
"Well, I suppose we should go home."
"I suppose so," Ish agrees.
"Thank you for helping," I say.
"I'm in the book too, don't forget," she says. "I want to find out what happens."
That night sees the worst riots yet in Athens. While the new Greek government huddles inside the old royal palace, Zegna Square is alight. Cars burn like pagan fires, gunshots streak through the black sky. Masked protesters and masked police come together with a thunderclap that can be felt in the chest even thousands of miles away. Next morning, I have nervous clients on the line as soon as I turn on my phone, and at 10 a.m., I see Walter's limousine pull up outside. Nobody from his office calls me, they just assume I will know he is there, which, to my embarrassment, I do. In the back seat, Walter is livid. What are those gobshites doing over there? Will their fucking shambles of a government last a week? If it falls and Greece tells its creditors to go to fuck, what then? I tell him that his investments have been spread across a wide portfolio precisely to protect them from this kind of shock, and that in fact Dublex will most likely benefit from the increased volatility in terms of security contracts. It's the same speech I gave him a few weeks ago when Spanish banks teetered, and a few weeks before that when it was Portugal on the brink. Every time his fears are harder to dislodge, as if he can see the flaming torches massed outside his house.
I don't see what he's so worried about, Kevin comments when I return. It's not like he's going to run out of money, whatever happens. The more you have, the greater your fears of losing it.
Jocelyn Lockhart says,
classic human psychology.
In Somalia, you worry about an empty rice bowl.
Gary McCrum concurs.
In the suburbs, you worry about burglars running off with your flat-screen TV. But if you're a billionaire, what would it take for a billionaire to lose everything?
I don't know, Kevin says.
Well, Walter fucking knows, I guarantee you. Walter lies awake every night conjuring up whatever kind of Boschian nightmare you'd need to make any serious dent in his fortune. Defaulting Greeks are just one pixel in the fucking IMAX screen of unrelenting carnage that's the inside of that man's head.
That's why serious players never quit while they're ahead, Jocelyn says. They're always rushing off to make more billions to protect the billions they have already. Looking for that little bit more that'll make them bulletproof. But then there's more for them to worry about. It's a vicious circle, see?
So, Kevin looks deeply troubled by this information. Are you saying they shouldn't bother?
They'd be better off not being rich.
No, I'm saying they need to tighten their focus, Jocelyn says. If you're worried about the apocalypse, you want to be invested in two things and two things only. Weapons and gold. And by gold, I mean actual bullion you can hold in your hand, not some certificate. Then when it all goes tits up, you're ready. Fortress in the Swiss Alps with an underground generator and its all water supply. Maybe 300 mercenaries to take out any famos who come looking to get in. Sorted.
Famos?
Yeah, from the famine, you know.
An island would be better, Gary McCrum asserts, with a self-sustaining farm.
Oh yeah, an island's the ideal, Jocelyn says. Though you're probably going to have to cut back on your mercenaries a bit.
Or get robot mercenaries, Kevin says.
Nice, Jocelyn says.
You should say that to Walter. He'd be well impressed.
You think?
Kevin says.
Might even sign you up for a place in the fortress, Jocelyn says. You could look out the window and watch us all burn.
Kevin beams, as though he would like this very much indeed. At last a quiet moment presents itself. I use my mobile so the bank won't record the call. The line is poor, and the girl who answers doesn't seem to know anything about Paul.
You published his novel, I tell her, For Love of a Clown, surely you know it.
The girl tells me, rather peevishly, that it must have been before her time, then puts me on hold. A moment later, a second voice, a man's, comes on the line. He introduces himself as Paul's editor. Warily, as if he suspects some kind of scam, he tells me that while Asterisk Press did indeed publish Paul's first novel, they have had no contact with him for some time.
Really?
This strikes me as strange. He has not been in touch regarding his new book, The Story of an Everyman Working in a Mid-Tier Investment Bank?
No.
The editor replies,
we haven't heard anything from him at all.
Hmm, I say, and then, perhaps you have an address where I can contact him?
Sorry, he says, we can't give that information out to strangers.
Yes, but I'm not really a stranger, I explain. You see, I am the everyman whose adventures will appear in his next novel.
He apologizes again, invites me to leave a message which he can pass on, though he adds that Paul has not replied to any correspondence for several years, so they don't know even if the address they have is the right one. A series of phone calls to literary magazines and institutions in Dublin proves scarcely more informative. Of the few people who remember him, one insists that he is dead and refuses to be persuaded otherwise even when I tell him I recently had lunch with him. Nevertheless, a picture begins to emerge. One acquaintance makes reference to the writer's disappointment over the reception of Clown. Several speak about a hostile review in the national press. Once I retrieve this review, which is hidden behind a paywall, his retreat from the literary world becomes considerably less of a mystery. How can something so trivial feel so exhausting? Reading this deeply unfunny, unintentionally depressing book, one might be tempted to conclude that the novel, like the circus, has simply had its day, and that novelists have come to inhabit the same territory as the clown chosen here as protagonist, once beloved figures so outmoded that they now inspire only pity and incomprehension.
Fucking hell, he says.
Yet this book comes on the heels of Bimal Banerjee's masterful The Clowns of Sorrow, in which the obsolescence of these forgotten jokers gives them a tragic grandeur, confronting us with the unbreachable gulf between ourselves and the past.
I fall silent, skimming down the page. Ish nudges me.
What else?
There is a lot of stuff here about Banerjee continuing Joyce's great hermeneutic project.
What about Paul?
Frowning, I read down to the last paragraph. She thinks he should not write any more novels.
Right, I got that.
And it seems that, for many years, he took her advice. I think back to that first conversation, the wall he said he'd hit with his work. Now it appears in quite a different light, yet these discoveries have brought him no closer, and we must resort to desperate measures.
What the fuck is that thing? Kevin says.
Telephone directory, I say.
Landlines?
Kevin says.
Who still has a landline?
I keep a landline for when I need to find my mobile, Jocelyn says. We've got a maid to do that, Gary says.
There are 10 men listed who have the same name as the writer. Whenever Jürgen isn't within earshot, I go through them one by one. Over the course of the evening, I manage to make contact with a butcher, an upholsterer, a sound engineer, a data miner, and a retired army captain who served with the United Nations in the Biafran War. They know nothing about my Paul, yet I can't shake the sense of them as facets of a crystal, different aspects of the same entity. The men he might have become in different circumstances, at a different time, with different choices. As I put the phone down for the last time, I have one of those dizzy moments, the vertigo that comes when, just for an instant, you get an inkling of how vast the world is, how populous and unknowable. Then it recedes again and is gone.
What about that number there?
Ish points to an uncrossed name at the top of the list. It's disconnected.
That doesn't mean there's no one there. Think about it. If this was a book, where would the one person you were looking for turn out to be? It's always the place with the disconnected phone, right?
She keeps prodding me until I look the address up. It turns out that 323 Superbia is only 10 minutes' walk from the centre. And so, mostly to mollify her, I agree to pay it a visit.
When? She says.
Soon, I promise.
I can't wait that long. The suspense is killing me.
All right, all right. Taking the lift down to the plaza, I follow the tram tracks in the direction of the train station until I pass out of the center. And here, on the teeming road, are the Irish. Blanched, pocked, pitted, sleep-deprived, burnished, beaming, snaggle-toothed, balding, rouged, raddled, beaky, exophthalmic,
The Irish, with their demon priests, their cellulite, their bus queues and beer bellies, their foreign football teams, betting slips, smartphones and online deals, their dyed hair, white jeans, colossal mortgages, miraculous medals, ill-fitting suits, enormous televisions, stoical laughter, wavering camaraderie, their flinty austerity and seeping corruption, their narrow minds and broad hearts, their drunken speeches, drunken fights, drunken weddings, drunken sex, their books, saints, tickets to Australia, their building site countryside, their radioactive sea, their crisps, bars, Lucozade, their tattoos, their overpriced wine and mediocre restaurants, their dreams, their children, their mistakes, their punch bag history, their bankrupt state, and their inveterate difference. Every face is a compendium of singularities unadulterated by the smoothing toxins of wealth and privilege. To walk among them is to be plunged into a sea of stories, a human comedy so rich it seems on the point of writing itself. For a moment I wonder hopelessly what the International Financial Services Center can offer to compare. Then I remember that this was his very point, that the storyless, faceless banks are the underwriters of all this humanity, that we are the fates who weave the fabric of the day. Coming from the center, with its clean lines and ubiquitous dress code, the chaos of detail is almost overwhelming. I take refuge in the map on my phone. It takes me off the thoroughfare and into a warren of flats and terraced houses. There are no cars, no people, just boarded up windows, incoherent graffiti, detritus so random it seems deliberate. The further I go, the worse it gets, till the very molecules of the air and brickwork seem on the point of fraying, drifting apart to leave yawning rents of pure nothingness. And then, in the midst of this desolation, I come upon a large, glittering tower. To say it appears out of place would be an understatement. It looks like a 5-star hotel that has been stolen from some exclusive neighborhood of Shanghai or Los Angeles and then dumped here. Gilt filigree gleams from the railings of the balconies. Mosaics twinkle on the dark stone of the facade. A majestic eagle peers down from the distant rooftop. From one side of the building hangs an enormous hoarding. Beneath the marks of rain and dust, it shows in black and white two willowy girls with coal-ringed eyes gazing hungrily over basketball-sized wine glasses at a smirking young man in very tight jeans who has hoisted himself up to sit on the kitchen counter, car keys flung in some obscure invitation onto the table in front of him. All three figures balance sunglasses in their hair, as if life could at any moment become too radiant to behold. The strapline below them reads, "Superbia, enter beauty." The entrance door to the lobby is flanked by two stone effigies, one of which holds an intercom. There is no response from 323, or indeed anything to indicate the intercom is working. Impulsively, I try the door, and it gives way. The lobby is full of silence and dust. Nymphs bathe in dust in an ornate fountain. Dust cloaks the tall mirrors along the walls. Gaps have appeared in the Moorish tiling, and the nameplates of the metal letterboxes are empty. The lift is not working, so I mount the stairs in intermittent light. No sound can be heard anywhere. Reaching the third floor, I make a left, but after a short distance, run into a thick plastic sheet that hangs like a filthy veil from ceiling to floor. Pushing it aside, I can just make out a lightless corridor studded by pockets of deeper darkness, doorways to rooms, or the shells of rooms. From somewhere, a sharp, scurrying noise issues. I hurry back the way I came, turn a corner, then another, then stop and try to orient myself and realize I am standing outside apartment number 323. Mostly as a formality, I lift my hand to knock, and then I hear a voice.
"You pawned it,"
it says, and then again,
"You pawned it?"
"That's right," says another voice, a woman's.
"Jesus, Clitzia!"
The man sounds very like Paul, though his tone is different from any I've heard him use.
"What am I supposed to work on?"
"Work?"
The woman's voice, fierce and heavily accented, crows.
"You tell me the day you want to work, I go out and buy you a brand new one. Work? This is a big joke. I am laughing."
His tone hardens.
"But where's the money, so?"
"What money?"
"The money for my damn writing desk, that's what money."
"He's gone."
gone! You spent it? All of it?
Heavy footsteps pound the floor.
And what? Lottery tickets? I bought food, idiot. I bought food so we all starve. That's great! And what are we going to do tomorrow? What are we going to do tomorrow when the food's gone and my desk is gone? Oh, yes, tomorrow is when you are going to make the big monies, I forget. Well, what's your plan exactly? Pawn the floorboards? Pawn the damn oxygen in the air? I leave you, that's what. I leave you. I wish you would leave me.
The man roars back.
I wish you would leave me. Then I could get some peace and quiet. I wish one of us had the courage to bring this nightmare to an end, so I could at least look forward to dying a...
Oh, hello, Claude.
Somewhere around Nightmare, the storming footsteps rapidly increased in volume, and now the door has been flung open and Paul and I find ourselves looking at each other. I don't know which of us is more surprised, although he works quickly to compose his features, transforming swiftly from conjugal fury to boggling horror to mild bemusement.
I didn't expect to see you,
he says in a tone of strained jollity. I was just in the neighborhood, I say in a similar tone. For a moment, we stare at each other through the masks of our untruths. Then, realizing he has no choice, Paul makes an ushering gesture.
Won't you come in?
I don't want to intrude.
Don't be silly, please.
He ushers me into a lavishly appointed room. Something like Tutankhamun's tomb might have looked like if they had decided to bury him in a modern kitchen. Every inch abounds with design features, spotlights, LED displays, gold-plated knobs and rails and switches that so bedazzle me it takes me a moment to register the young woman who stands behind the island. She has platinum blonde hair and a simmering expression. Her left hand is curled around a mug in the manner of one about to lob a grenade.
From the wall, the silenced television throws violently jumping light all over her face.
Claude, this is my wife, Clitzia, Paul says. Darling, this is Claude, the man who's been very kindly helping me out with my project these last few weeks.
Charmed, the woman says sullenly.
You never told me you had a wife, I say to Paul in the joshing avuncular tone we established a moment ago, though in the claustrophobic atmosphere it is fighting for its life.
And you,
Paul says, wagging his finger at me humorously,
are not supposed to be here. I thought we'd agreed you didn't need to know anything about my life.
Yes, that's true, but for the last couple of weeks you have not come to work.
Ha!
The woman says. Paul turns to her.
Darling, do you mind?
She shrugs, tosses her platinum locks, and then with deliberate slowness slouches over to the sink where she pours herself a glass of water and, raising her chin over her long white neck, slowly drinks it, continuing to gaze at me as she does so. She is almost extremely beautiful. Her features, from a formal point of view, are perfect. Large, oceanic eyes, exquisite cheekbones, a mouth that, though I have never seen a pomegranate, irresistibly recalls pomegranates, or some epic, perfect work of pornography. Yet there is a hardness to them, as though they have been carved from some material whose first allegiance was not to beauty. Adamantine, titanium, industrial diamond. The same might be said for the aggressive curves of her body, today squeezed into an old-fashioned floral dress whose pastoral innocence they mock so relentlessly it seems almost cruel.
You did not come to work, I repeat, and so I started to worry I'm sorry, something is watching me from under the table.
Under the... Oh, for God's sake.
Paul crouches down and addresses the owner of the eyes.
Damn it, Remington, what are you doing down there? Why aren't you in bed?
I am in bed!
A high-pitched voice replies.
You're not in bed, you're under the table. I can see you quite clearly.
This is my bed!
The voice explains.
Because I'm a dog!
You're not a... Just get out of there.
Paul stretches his hand between the chairs and extricates a small boy with grubby knees.
How long have you been down there? Were you listening to Mummy and Daddy's private conversation?
Dogs hear things people don't hear.
the child says mysteriously.
Go to bed.
Paul says,
your human bed.
Who is this? I ask.
This is my son, Remington.
Paul says, the boy is slight and resembles his mother, though in a softer, more benign way, the sharp edges rounded out and the porcelain skin spangled with amber freckles.
I'm four,
Remington says to me, and then,
dogs can talk.
Very nice to meet you, I say, shaking his diminutive hand.
Do you have any bones?
I'm afraid not.
Bow, wow, wow, wow!
Remington exclaims,
dogs like bones!
That's enough, Remington. Now, as to the novel, I've had some very...
dogs like barking! Bow, wow, wow!
Paul turns to his wife with a pained expression.
Can't you do something with him?
Certainly, darling, Clitia says. You want I take him to nursery? Or bring him for a stroll around garden?
Bow, wow, wow!
Barks Remington, tearing around the limited floor space.
Bow, wow, 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 wow!
Paul pulls his hands down his face.
I'm losing me fucking mind here.
Why don't I just ring for Nanny?
Clitia says brightly. Her husband responds with an expletive, and in an instant, while I stand there in a paroxysm of embarrassment, the argument begins all over again.
Mom and Dad are always fighting,
Remington whispers to me confidentially.
It's because I'm bad.
I'm sure you're not bad, I say. Remington pauses for a moment, contemplating this. Then he slaps his two hands over his eyes and will not reappear, no matter how I cajole. Clearly the best thing is for me to go, but as I make my way out of the apartment, picking my way past Louis XIV's chairs, black chandeliers, other signature excesses of the Celtic tiger, something catches my eye. On a stack of loose papers scattered over an approximately desk-sized area of floor sits the red notebook. I flinch. It's like seeing Excalibur resting in the umbrella stand, or the Maltese falcon propping up a lowboy. I glance over my shoulder. Clitia is issuing a torrent of foreign words that sound vaguely like backwards French. Paul is shouting that he will have her deported. I look back. The notebook calls to me like a siren from a rock, enjoining me to turn its pages. I know I shouldn't, yet something is not right here, and it may hold the answer. Nobody pays attention to me as I edge over and lift it from the floor. With a dizzying sense of anticipation and dread, I go to the first page. It is blank. I turn to the next page. It is blank. I begin to feel a queer sort of chill, like a draft blowing down the hallways of my being. Fuck you, Clitia is bellowing at Paul. Fuck you! The next page, the one after, and the one after that, blank. The page following is filled with handwritten text, a single word, blah, 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 repeated to take up the whole page. Opposite is a crude cartoon, a stick man in the basket of a hot air balloon. The stick man wears a crown and holds a bag marked with a euro symbol in either hand. On the page after that, a doodle of a camel, then more pages featuring similar doodles, either of breasts or of erect penises or of erect penises defiling the breasts in one way or another. Then I come to a sequence of what seems to be measurements. Measurements, diagrams that seem ominously familiar, and a few pages later, a heading in capitals. Who's our mark?
Whoa, what are you doing with that?
Before I can read any further, Paul has appeared and snatched the book out of my hand. My head snaps back, my vision swims. Who's our mark? The question jigs mockingly before me.
You know you're not allowed to see that.
Paul scolds, stowing the notebook in a drawer. It's empty, I say, though my voice seems to come from elsewhere.
Well, it's just rough notes, Paul says. A word here and there, aides, memoirs, you'd call them. Our conversations, our stories, the time you spent with us.
All up here. He taps his head with an index finger. Locked away in the vault, don't you worry.
I barely hear him. I feel like I've been drugged, and that line keeps flashing up at me. Who is Mark?
I'm sorry?
You have written, who's our Mark? What does this mean?
Oh, that's nothing. Just an old idea I didn't end up using.
Perhaps you thought it might be a good name for the everyman before you met me? I reason faintly.
Yes, that's exactly it.
He agrees, guiding me towards the door. And it sounds plausible, yet I can still feel the question descending through me. Who's our Mark? Rearranging everything like some powerful agaric hidden in a plate of food.
Now why don't you head back home?
He reaches for the door handle,
and first thing tomorrow I'll come in and tell you all about this new direction I've thought up.
Who's our Mark? Fragments whirl before my eyes, snatches of old films, Humphrey Bogart, Jimmy Cagney. What are they saying to each other? I lean in to read the subtitles.
Claude?
Rather than just working in the bank, instead, we have him rob the bank.
God is everything.
And up from the dark depths, silent and swift as a shark, the truth now surges into view. The Mark, the patsy, the mug, the sucker.
Lugugu,
I hear myself whisper. What? C'est bon pour les gugu.
The words come out without me knowing why.
And as if I'd uttered a magic spell, whatever is the exact opposite of a magic spell, in an instant I understand everything. There is no novel. I say,
what?
He seems baffled.
What are you talking about? Of course there's a novel.
How I yearn to believe him. Yet even as I look at him, he seems changed. The artist of the last weeks vanished, his place taken by this other man. Furtive, contingent, mired in the trash of the everyday. It's like when you find out your lover has been unfaithful in one horrible instant. Everything she was to you, the whole beautiful enchantment, falls away. And you see her as she really is. Mortal, machinating, tethered like everyone else to a little patch of space and time. And the worst of it is that you knew all along.
He is still making protestations of innocence. I let them wash over me. Everything is clear now, terribly, unforgivingly clear. The novel was simply a ploy to win my trust and get him into the bank. From there he would have free rein to plan his theft. And Igor, or whatever his name is, he is not an experimental poet.
Well, I mean, not precisely.
He is a pest exterminator, Clitia says. He is the brains of the operation, she adds sardonically.
You're not helping. Claude, listen, we can still make this happen. Nothing has changed.
He goes on, he entreats and implores, he issues a myriad offers and possibilities, but the words have become meaningless, as if he were speaking another language. For a moment I watch his mouth gobble without hearing what it says. Then I rise to my feet. I have to go.
You don't know what it's been like for me these last years, the pressure I'm under.
I trudge heavily back around the table. He lays a hand on my arm.
Look, it's true. I needed something to tide us over. But just so I can finish what I'm working on, I've got something up my sleeve so big it'll make all of us rich. Rich!
I shake him loose and open the door. Walk through the darkness to the stairwell.
There's no need to involve the authorities!
Paul cries after me as I begin my descent.
2. In the Abyss. Life is something so hideous that the only way to endure it is to escape it, and one escapes by living in art. Gustave Flaubert.
Wow.
Eve sits back in her chair, fingering the chain around her neck.
Mercurial,
Jürgen says.
Very, very mercurial.
And you're sure about all this? Ish says.
You couldn't just have, I don't know, got your wires crossed?
Perhaps this is just another part of the research, Jürgen suggests. Perhaps he is now working on the story of a novelist who tries to rob a bank.
It was a scam, I say. The monotonous sound of my own voice infuriates me. All of it.
Just like a man.
Ish, with a sudden access of fierceness, gets to her feet, setting her earrings a-jingle.
They promise you the moon and the stars, but they're only after the one bloody thing. They are seeking to burgle your safe box,
Jürgen says. Too bloody right, Ish says. I am wondering now what is the next step, I say. I suppose we must tell the police.
Jürgen pulls thoughtfully on the end of his pen. I am not so sure. On one hand, it seems clear that Paul's plan was a failure. On the other, did you take the notebook with you?
I shake my head.
Yes, I suspect in that case his plot will be difficult to prove. Without hard evidence, it will come down to his word against yours. Furthermore, the negative publicity for the bank would be significant. The idea that BOT's top analysts were fooled by such an obvious trick, that they sat idly by while prospective bank robbers measured the walls, is not one shareholders will enjoy. My preference would be to keep the incidents to ourselves. I will have the small word with security to make sure everything is in order. If it is, we will drop the entire matter. Anyone asks, we can simply tell them the project did not work out.
His calm surprises me.
I expected him to be apoplectic, to hurl office equipment across the room, to plot revenge using the whole mighty legal machinery at our disposal, to express all the rage that I, consumed by shame, cannot. I know that Paul has done a terrible thing, he says. Taking advantage of our trust, manipulating us for his own ends, to say nothing of attempted robbery. These are undeniably heinous acts. At the same time, we must remember that artists are not bound by our conventional morality. To a bourgeois sensibility, trying to rob a bank is plainly wrong, but for an artist, it is different. In fact, didn't a famous poet once say, bad artists borrow, great artists steal?
I don't think he was talking about stealing money, I point out.
Perhaps not. Nevertheless, we cannot condemn the panther for killing the gazelle. That is simply its nature. The artist is fundamentally a transgressive figure. Michelangelo, Bob Marley, in fact, the entire original lineup of the Wailers, these were all men censured by their times. In banking, too, there are moments when we must act in ways that ordinary Johns would condemn as dishonest or unethical in order to succeed. So let us not rush to judge. Maybe he came around us under false pretenses. Maybe he lied to us about putting us in a novel. But Paul changed us. And because of him, we will never be the same again.
My life hasn't changed one bit, Ish says. Mine neither, I say. It is exactly the same.
A plant does a lot of its growing underground,
Jürgen says mysteriously.
Anyway, as soon as one story ends, a new one is beginning. This morning, I have heard from Rachel's office that an extremely powerful private investor has taken an interest in the Irish financial sector. Apparently, BOT is near the top of the list of investment banks under consideration to be his agent.
And with that, Paul and his book are put back on the shelf. The oddity, the intrigue of the past week simply dissolves, as if it had been merely a divertissement, like a juggler on the plaza whom the temps observe as they eat their panini before the security guards arrive to chase him away. Normality returns. I send emails and study reports. I attend meetings and write notes. I pay my credit card bill and upgrade my broadband speed. At night, I put myself on the rack, demand to know how I let myself be taken in. Yet there is no mystery to it. My life is interesting. My life has meaning. The other people, strangers, will want to know about my life. He told me what I wanted to hear.
It's the same trick we use with clients every day. They prefer buying to selling. They prefer gaining a little to losing a lot. They want to invest in Apple because they like their iPhone, and we say, that's just what you should do, and take their money. People will believe anything if it's what they want to hear. The extremely powerful private investor turns out to be none other than Porter Blankley's old friend, the Caliph of Oran, or to be exact, Tordale, his sovereign wealth fund. The Caliph of Oran? Ish frowns. Isn't he some sort of dictator? That's right, Jürgen says. He is one of the most successful dictators in the world. His personal wealth is believed to be in the tens of billions, and in the current situation that is growing by the hour. What is the current situation? Ish says.
Unrest, I say. Uprisings.
Indeed, Jürgen says. Anti-government demonstrations throughout the Arab world have had a highly disruptive effect on oil production. Oran's capacity, however, has not been affected. Instead, the hike in prices has brought the caliphate spectacular profits. Now his sovereign wealth fund is seeking to diversify.
How do you find us?
He says, blankly.
I think on this occasion we may have Walter to thank, Jürgen says.
Walter Corliss? He's doing some construction work out there, I remember.
Yes, the Caliph is taking measures to fortify his oil fields and private city in case the unrest spreads, Jürgen says. My surmise is that Walter may have spoken informally to his finance people. Officially, they are interested in investing in the Irish banking sector. Unofficially, I hear that they are considering shifting their entire operation to Dublin. The light regulatory regime may suit their needs. A delegation is coming over at the end of the week to hear presentations.
They're not giving us much time to prepare, are they?
Ish says. No doubt that is part of the evaluation process. Consequently, it is very important that we...
But his words are drowned out by a tremendous pounding. What could it be? Construction work in the plaza? A controlled explosion on a nearby building? I look out for an explanation and then find it poised sculpturally in front of me. Ariadne has come to our table. The sound is the beating of my own idiotic heart.
You are ready to order?
The others go first. I pretend to study the menu in order to hide my blushes.
And for you?
I start to speak, but it turns into a cough. Finally, I struggle out. Nothing for me, thank you.
Very good.
She smiles, sashays away.
Not having anything, Claude?
Are you feeling okay?
I'm fine, just not very hungry.
I sink back into my chair, attempting to conceal my labored breathing.
So, this presentation. Yes, so Liam wants them to meet Rachel first, and then our team afterwards.
I concentrate as best I can, but talking about investment with Ariadne in the room is like trying to read the business news by the light of a meteor shower. Finding out the novel was a fake hasn't dimmed her appeal. On the contrary, every day as lunchtime approaches, I find myself getting giddy. I turn brick red when she greets me, then squeak like an adolescent when she asks for my order. What is happening? It's as if, simply by making the suggestion, Paul had set something in motion, as if the story had taken on a life of its own, like a genie freed from a lamp. It makes no sense. I've spent many hours patiently talking to myself out of it. Still, the feelings refuse to leave me. And I keep coming back to the fact that this is where Paul said the story should go. True, he said it in the course of trying to rob the bank, but could it be that his instincts remained sound, even when used to deceive? Could he have picked up on something between us, a latent connection waiting to be made? Is it my imagination, or has Ariadne noticed it too? Does she look at me now with a clouded sort of a frown, as though there's some fact about me that she can't quite lay her hands on? On some unconscious level, is she too waiting for our story to begin?